It's Wednesday, the 9th of March, and our agenda today is informational meetings from the Department of Agriculture and from the Department of Forestry. We have agriculture scheduled first. Is that...
Forestry second.
Well, whatever is going to work for you guys. Okay. Would you come ahead, please, and let's proceed. The agenda, of course, as far as we're concerned, is principally, anything that, you know, is in that you think is important or valuable for us should be part of the agenda. But the specific part of the agenda that we're concerned with is report that you should have made to OEB and how you have or have not been involved with the Oregon plan over the course of the biennium, and what's going good, what's going bad, what are the accomplishments, what are the failures, and anything else that in that line that you think would be good for the committee to be aware of. So with no further ado, Sandy doesn't have any comments for us today, folks, so we will open then the informational meeting with the Oregon Department of Agriculture on the Oregon plan. And good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Jensen and other members of the committee. I'm Debbie Gorham. I'm the administrator of the Natural Resources Division at Department of Agriculture, and we're most pleased to come back and update you on the role of ODA in the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. What I thought we would do is to walk you through the different program areas through which we do contribute to the Oregon Plan, and those include what's known as Senate Bill 1010, the Ag Water Quality Management Plan, the Confined Animal Feeding Operations Program, the Soil and Water Conservation District Program, and our efforts to reduce invasive species and manage weeds in Oregon. And we do have a handout for you, and it follows along with the PowerPoint presentation that we have prepared. And I will invite my colleagues who manage several of these programs to walk you through, starting with Senate Bill 1010, Ray Jandel.
Good afternoon, Representative Jensen, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. My name is Ray Jandel. I'm the Assistant Administrator for the Natural Resources Division, and I have been focused on the Senate Bill 1010 program, the Ag Water Quality Management Program, for the last about 14 years now, it seems like. Basically, Senate Bill 1010 was established in 1993, and it directs the department to prevent and control water pollution from agricultural activities and soil erosion and to achieve applicable water quality standards. That's the nuts and bolts of that bill. In order to achieve that, we have a somewhat different approach than what we have seen with other state agencies. With the Department of Forestry, you'll see in a little bit, they have a practices-based program. We were directed to develop an outcome-based program. Basically, that means it's a non-prescriptive process. It's one where we identify what we're trying to achieve, and then it's up to the landowner to decide what kind of practices he or she might choose to be able to achieve that. So, for example, an outcome might be riparian condition is consistent with site capability to prevent soil erosion, to provide stream bank stability, and shade. A landowner can choose whatever suite of practices he might need, whether it's through grazing or farming or whatever else they might be doing, to be able to do that. This program is based on a watershed basis, which is somewhat different as well, in that we were directed that there's very unique circumstances around the state. You have the cranberry growers down in the southwest corner of the state, which is very different than the wheat farmers in the northeast corner of the state, and each group felt they needed to have ability to be involved with it at the local level to help direct it to address their specific concerns. And so we have developed a program on a watershed-based, and it's, we say voluntary, in that we are trying to achieve as much as this through voluntary efforts as possible. We feel most landowners are willing to do what needs to be done as long as they know what we're trying to achieve. And so they will pursue that. But we also need to provide a regulatory backstop for situations where there are egregious violations that are detrimental to the waters of the state. We have worked then on a watershed basis in 39 different planning areas around the state to work with local groups, 10 to 12, 12 to 14, 15 individuals, to develop a plan which identifies what are the issues as they relate to water quality, how can they be addressed in that area through agriculture practices, monitoring programs to identify how things are going, educational outreach, things like that are all defined in the plan. And when that plan is adopted, there's also a set of rules for that basin which describe the specific expectations for that area. As I said, this bill was passed in 1993. With the Oregon plan being passed in 1997, we were given new direction on how quickly we should develop this and resources to do that. And by 2004, we were able to finish up the last of the plans to adopt them and begin implementing them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Can you tell us how these planning areas were determined?
The planning areas were determined at several levels. The first one was to look at the various watersheds that are hydrologic units, if you will, identified by the National the Geologic Service. And so it just looks at a watershed and says these exist in the state. There's 96 of them, something like that. We then started looking at those and looking at our resources and workload, and also looked at the agricultural activities and the sociological units, and began to realize that the two or three or four or five basins may be right beside each other. And they work together quite well. The sociological unit, the county grazing association or the Farm Bureau Association would accumulate a couple of those watersheds. And so we started looking at those natural connections and brought it down to 39 individual basins or planning areas, which recognize unique watersheds and unique planning units for the sociological issues and agricultural issues that exist there. And that's how that was developed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
The current status is, as I indicated, we have adopted plans and rules throughout the state, and now we're in the process of implementing those plans and rules. That includes a number of different things. One of those is biennial reviews. The groups that we work with to develop these plans and rules said, we're very interested in being involved with this throughout this process. It's going to go on for a little while now. We want to know how things are going on a regular basis. In terms of all the activities the department is pursuing, as well as the local management agency, which is usually the Soil and Water Conservation District, as well as the individual landowners who are doing actions to implement the plan. So these biennial reviews, every 2 years we get together with that group, brief them on that, and provide that report to the Board of Agriculture so they're aware of it as well. Part of the process is the compliance investigations. As I said, we have enforceable rules to be able to address issues that are identified in the basin. We receive complaints from landowners that something is occurring that they think is causing water pollution from ag activity, and our staff will go out and investigate that, document it, and determine whether or not it is a violation, and then work with the landowner to try to resolve the issue. Most of the time, this attempt to do this is through a proactive effort, as I said, but there is a regulatory civil penalty portion that is available if necessary. We have been applying this again since 96. That's when the first plan was adopted, and there's been no civil penalties needed to date because we have been able to resolve the issues prior to the need to go to that extra step. So we've been pleased with that. We also are responsible for evaluating the program for effectiveness. One of the big concerns is what are we doing? You know, what is this plan rule process doing? How are we able to accomplish this? Is it achieving what is desired to be done? And we have developed some monitoring programs to look at the number of activities that are going on, but we're also looking at utilizing existing data that others are collecting. For example, the DEQ collects water quality data on a regular basis, and we are identifying those specific sites that are connected with a predominantly agricultural area as a means to look at changes that are occurring, and we can then have an ability to evaluate whether it's due to our program or not. We're also looking at riparian areas. We're concerned about how are riparian areas changing, improving, being affected by our program, and we have developed a monitoring strategy to do that. It's relatively new, and we're quite excited about it. We think it's going to be a real effective tool to help us evaluate that. Outreach to landowners, we're really interested in continuing that. Working with our soil and water conservation districts, which are our local management agencies, they are working with landowners through workshops, newspaper articles, one-on-one contact, helping them develop plans, doing CREP, which is a program we'll be describing a little bit. And we're also looking to for ongoing technical assistance. The state legislature has been providing funding over the last number of biennium for us to distribute to districts to provide technical assistance to landowners, and that is one area that's greatly appreciated by landowners and districts, and everyone comes back and says that's one of the most effective tools we have. So we appreciate that support. Results to date, just quickly brief on those. One is increase in landowner knowledge and participation. One thing I noticed since I've been there for since 93, landowners are now really knowledgeable about the water quality standards, the effect that they have on that, how that fits into the TMDL process. And I think that was due to the Senate Bill 1010 process. If you're dealing with 39 different basins with 12 to 15 individuals per basin, plus the public hearings we do associated with the rules, quite a bit of exposure to local landowners. And so the increase in knowledge and how they interact with these various state and federal laws has been tremendous. I know here that EPA is satisfied with state efforts in this regard. I don't say they're pleased. I don't say they're completely there with us, but they're willing to give us a chance. They see it as one of the best tools they have to date. It is part of the TMDL process that DEQ is involved with. It's our ag's portion of that. And they're saying, okay, we'll accept the TMDLs with this process in place, and we think that we're willing to watch it and see that it is effective and monitor it as it goes along. We're also looking at improvements in water quality. This is one of the more difficult ones to do because when you look at agriculture, it's usually interspersed with a bunch of other activities in a basin, so it's hard to single out ag as improving water quality. And also the long-term dynamics of the systems preclude us from getting strong evidence at this point in time, and due to the youth of the program too, since it's only many of the plants have only been in place for 1 to 5 years, it hasn't been in place long enough to see major changes. The Tualatin Basin was adopted in 1996, so it's the oldest plan and rule that we have in place, and we've been collecting data along with our counterparts up there since 94, and we've seen statistically significant improvements in dissolved oxygen for several creeks up there, as well as improving trends in temperature in several creeks. So we are seeing some changes. That's an indication that this program is moving in the direction that it was expected to. At that point, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Larry Oliwuk. That's the extent of the Senate Bill 1010 discussion I want to present, and have him talk somewhat about the soil and water conservation districts and how they are contributing to this effort.
Before we do that, could I ask, do you have some kind of report or compilation of the results of these measures that you've been going over here? I realize we're looking a little at the Tualatin here, but as you indicate, that's only one of 39 basins. What are the results? What do we have around the rest of the state, or is that what we're getting to in the next?
You're talking about monitoring data and the effects that our program is having on water quality and riparian condition. That data, again, our program is so new that we have, we do not have a large amount. We don't have data collected at this point in time that's reported. The other than the DEQ data that we are connecting with the agricultural dominated areas, I can pull that together and get a report to you on that if you'd like.
Okay, I appreciate it if you would.
Okay.
Let's see. I thought I had the biennial reviews. Are every one of the 39 submitting biennial reviews now, or do you have reviews for everyone?
We have reviews, Representative Jensen, Chair Jensen. We have reviews for all the basins that have been in place for at least 2 years.
For at least a year?
2 years.
2 years.
This is binding review, so if they've been in place for 2 years, we have that accomplished. In the case of the Tualatin, it's been around since 96, and so we have at least two.
We've got to be careful about getting into the Tualatin. We've got a member that has too much familiarity with it.
I recognize
that. So we want to, you know, keep that to a minimum and talk about some of the other things that we have in the state. How many of the 39 have been in place for at least 2 years?
I would off the top of my head, about 24, I think is what it is.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. Proceed.
Representative Jensen and committee members, for the record, my name is Larry Oyewa. I'm the program manager for the Soil and Water Conservation District Program. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about the contributions the districts are making to the Oregon Plan and to the local communities. Before I get to that first slide, maybe it'd be helpful to say a little bit about what soil and water conservation districts are. Maybe you're all familiar with them, but there are 45 soil and water conservation districts in the state. And those districts are represented by 291 elected officials, directors that serve 4-year terms in most cases, unless they're appointed, which they'd serve a shorter term. There's also one tribal conservation district formed by federal law up in the Umatilla area. And so we work very closely with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and they serve as our local management agencies with funding we provide to them through the state budget, department budget, to implement and do outreach. And so I'll talk a little bit about that. Those first four bullets there are some of the main categories of work the districts do. They do education and outreach and advise the department on implementation of the programs, assist the landowners with management plans, and provide a variety of different types of technical assistance. The types of work you see there are funded partially by the department, but I think it's important to note that we are very fortunate to have districts that have, in some cases, local capacity, grant writing ability, access to federal farm bill dollars. So we're leveraging our dollars through the technical assistance and the work that the districts provide to get a much bigger body of resources and technical help to landowners.
Could I interrupt that? Maybe jumping a little bit ahead on you here, but if the Soil and Water Conservation Districts are to provide technical assistance, why am I hearing so much report out of OEB that one of the major funding issue needs that they have is for technical assistance?
Chairman Jensen, that's a very good question. As I mentioned, the funding we provide provides technical assistance. On average, I'd say the funding coming from the department could fund maybe one FTE to provide technical assistance. And as you can imagine, in your area, for example, with the CSP program and the number of landowners come in, does not meet the need of people walking in the door asking for technical assistance. And the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program is another good example I'll talk about a little bit later, where we've seen the interest by landowners increase exponentially when there's technical assistance available. So I think in many cases we've identified the barrier to getting more conservation on the ground is the technical assistance, and I think that's what you're hearing through OEB and others.
Thank you. I appreciate the response to that, but the purpose was, some of you may recall when we were talking to OEB that the technical assistance was one of the big things, and it's important to know that the existing is probably Soil and Water Conservation District probably inadequate to meet all of the demands, so it falls back then probably on OEB too. Although the chair might wonder if the Soil and Water Conservation Districts pursue with OEB some exterior funding so that they might have more of that technical assistance to provide for the on-the-ground operations outside of whatever it is that they're doing.
Chairman Jensen, if I understand your question correctly, you're asking if districts apply for grants to OEB for technical assistance? They certainly do.
Okay.
And we encourage them and actually in many cases work with them to put a project and a proposal together. So if you looked at the types of projects and grants that OEB funded over, say, the last year or 3 years or any period of time, you'll see that the recipients in many cases would be a district applying for either technical assistance or actual project money for a landowner.
Thank you.
Okay. So the types of things listed there are outreach and technical assistance. We gather information from districts on a quarterly basis, and so we have got some data in the next slide there that talks about the number of contact landowners contacted, conservation plans completed, practices that applied. And those practices would be things for soil erosion control, whether that's direct or minimum tillage, livestock watering facilities, irrigation water management, whole host of different kinds of conservation practices that address nearstream and upland issues. The question you just asked, Chairman Jensen, about developing grant and project proposals, that is another main function of districts. I mentioned that they leverage additional technical and financial assistance for landowners. The districts, in most cases, are housed with the USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service. So not in all cases. It kind of depends on how many field offices there are across the state. We have a very strong relationship with USDA, with districts, and also with the State Department of Agriculture, and we work very closely with them to try to access and use those federal farm bill programs as much as possible. Programs like the Environmental Qualities Incentive Program, Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, Wetland Reserve Program, there's a number of them that landowners can apply for. They do some monitoring, as Ray mentioned, and of course the biennial reviews. I think it's probably noteworthy to mention a couple key things that have happened primarily because of the leadership of some of the districts around the state. In your packet, you'll find a summary of, I think it's titled, Endangered Species Act Assurances. And this was a multi-year project that was spearheaded by the Wasco, Sherman, and Gillum County SWCDs. And the purpose of that project was to try to provide some Endangered Species Act assurances for landowners in that area. And they worked with NOAA Fisheries, NRCS, the Department of Agriculture, the Ag Industry, Resource Conservation and Development Councils, and a number of other groups. And what resulted from that was a biological opinion that was developed and issued by NOAA Fisheries that says if landowners have an approved conservation plan that takes into effect all the different planning criteria and features that NOAA Fishery and NRCS have agreed to, that they would have assurances from incidental take if they're implementing their plan. So it's a huge benefit and assurance for landowners in that area. And we're looking at ways to try to duplicate that effort in other parts of the state. Some districts have shown interest in trying to do that. The Wasco District in particular invested a tremendous amount of time and provided a lot of leadership for that. So it does take some capacity at the local level to make that whole thing happen.
So there's sure.
Yeah.
Thank you. I have a question about that, and actually regarding the assurances, it says here that on the third paragraph, or actually the bottom of the second paragraph, that the biological opinion covered non-irrigated cropland, rangeland, and pasture land, and wildlife areas and riparian areas associated with these land uses. But I would have to think that for those counties, wouldn't most of the cropland there be irrigated?
Representative Jensen and
Dryland Wheat.
Representative Dingfelder. They started with, in Wasco, Gillum, and Sherman County, they started with those three land uses because those are some of the predominant uses. Certainly there's irrigation in those areas. One of the challenges they faced was it was harder to get a biological opinion and agreement with NOAA Fisheries on irrigated land than it was on these other land uses. So they kind of took the low-hanging fruit first, to be quite honest. They have not given up that effort, and I think later on in the summary it talks about the work that districts are doing with NOAA Fisheries to try to get irrigated cropland also under that umbrella.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
A couple other things on that SWCD accomplishments page. The certified conservation planners. I think it's worth mentioning that some of the same planning criteria and certification that was used for the ESA insurances is something that is I guess the backbone of the planning process with USDA and districts. So in order to provide that detailed planning assistance, you have to be a certified conservation planner. So right now there's about 30 certified planners that work in districts. That number is fluctuating as more people get trained. Some people move on to different jobs, of course. But as we move into using the conservation security program, that's going to be one of the elements that will help producers qualify for that program. And there's a handout in your packet on the conservation security program. I won't go into all the details of that, but basically that's a program to reward people that are doing a high level of conservation. It's the term green payment is thrown around a lot in federal legislation, the Farm Bill. So Umatilla area was the first area in Oregon region to have that program. It pumped about $5.7 million into that region last year. There's 10 new areas in Oregon this year, and there's a map, I believe, in your packet as well that outlines where those areas are. So our districts are working with NRCS to try to gear up to provide that service and get those folks qualified for this year. A couple other things I think are really worth mentioning is the work down the Klamath. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with some of the challenges they faced in the past years. And as a result of the hard work and political efforts of the state and the local people in Klamath, there was a $50 million earmark for the Klamath Basin as part of the Farm Bill, which affects both California, the whole Klamath Basin, which is California and Oregon. The district played a very important role in there in helping people get into the office. They ran 7 days a week during the sign-up period, and it really helped the producers out there tremendously. In Marion County here locally, Marion's one of the six districts in the state to have a permanent tax rate, which really increases the ability for the districts to provide options. And they have their own cost share program. And that helps a lot of rural and, some cases, backyard landowners do conservation projects. And those folks wouldn't necessarily qualify for a USDA program and maybe not even an OEB grant. So that's really a tremendous benefit to the folks in Marion County. Conservation easements, we're seeing more interest in conservation easements. We've got one district, Yamhill, that is holding I think a 720-acre easement for a landowner that would approach the district and ask them to hold that. We're conducting trainings around the state, looking at ways to protect agriculture and ranch lands with conservation easements and providing information to districts. And the last thing is the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. And I'll just finish up by talking a bit about CREP, which is the next
one. Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Could you remind us what conservation easements are and conservation reserve enhancement programs are?
Yes, Chairman Jensen and Representative Tomei. I hope I pronounced that right.
Yes, you did.
Conservation easements are simply an easement, a property right that is granted to a third party, another party, on a negotiated basis. It could be a donated easement. It could be a paid easement that's paid for by another party. The most common things that districts are looking at and being approached on at this time is the district trying to find a way to keep land in agriculture production and ag and ranch land. So in the case of Yamhill County, that was driven partly and primarily, I believe, by estate planning issues where the landowners didn't want the property to be divided up in the event that there was estate taxes to transfer the property. So they placed restrictions on themselves that lowered the value of the property by not being able to divide it in smaller parcels, if you will, and that helped them out with tax benefits. But when you do that, when you place a restriction on it as an easement, then you have to have another third party hold that easement. I'm not sure if that
who might, Mr. Chair?
Follow.
Thank you. Who might that third party be?
It could be a land trust. There's several land trusts in Oregon. And in this case, it could be the district. It could be a city, a county. I think statutes chapter 197 that identifies all the legitimate holders of conservation easements. The state could hold the easement.
Follow up. So the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, is that similar to the conservation easement?
Chairman Jensen, Representative Tomei, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program is actually, and that'll tie me right to the next slide, so that'll work well.
Great.
It is a federal program that requires a state contribution. And in Oregon, we've got an agreement signed with the state of Oregon and U.S. Department of Agriculture to pay for planting of riparian areas, for a better word. It's a buffer program is what it is. So in Oregon, the state of Oregon picks up 25% of the cost of a rental program and the cost of restoring those riparian areas to trees. And again, it's a voluntary program. It's not an easement program. It's a rental program, and it's a 15-year rental program. So the agreement is between the landowner and the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just to finish up, the CREP program has really been a tremendous success. It specifically addresses some of the issues in the ag water quality plans that Ray mentioned. And the technical assistance we talked about earlier, what we did is two years ago, we did an assessment statewide of what the barriers were for producers to enter into this program. And the two top barriers were technical assistance and rental rates. And so we've tried to address that through funding from OWEB, Bonneville Power, and other places to get dedicated technical assistance. And we just finalized the renegotiation of our agreement with USDA that was signed in December that in many cases increased the rental rates. It also opened up the eligibility of the program statewide for any place there's an approved ag water quality plan, which is the whole state, and also on all tribal land. So this is a really good program. The chart that you see on the next page indicates, for example, the kinds of transverse and signups around the state. That's from Wasco County.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. I wanted to ask you about, do you set goals for the CREP program, whether it's county by county or district by district or statewide? Do you have a goal of X number of acreage or X number of landowners that you want to see? And do you measure? I mean, I didn't notice that as one of your benchmarks yesterday because I sat through all the ODA benchmarks, and I'm wondering that might be a good one if we – maybe you have it already.
Representative Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, there are goals set. On the agreements we're going to renegotiate, we're negotiating with districts to provide the technical assistance. We have a target amount of miles or acres that we try to get sign-ups. Early on, there was a goal, and I don't have the number in my head, that the state wanted to try to get X number of acres of buffers. And that's back in 2002 where we did this evaluation because we weren't getting there.
Mm-hmm.
And people were wondering why. And again, the two main reasons were because of the rental rates in some places and the technical assistance. So I don't know if there's specific goals statewide by region and 39 areas, but as we talk to districts and we try to get them to provide the technical assistance, we establish some expectations of how many plans and acres they'd put into place with the technical assistance money we provide. Does that help?
Yeah, I think Ray might.
He has a better answer, maybe.
Ray, do you have an idea about that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder. It's actually an OWEB program, and we're assisting them on that. So I do not know if they have a benchmark specifically identified for that. As Larry said, they did have an initial goal that they've been striving to. We lag getting it because of the technical assistance, but that could be part of the answer to your question why we specifically have not developed a benchmark for that.
All right. I'll talk to OWEB. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Could we take a moment here to review this. I think just pointing out that the relationship here, CREP program, is really one administered by OWEB, if I understand correctly. And a little bit of the history, colleagues, as far as this program is concerned. This was... And it's been about in 2001, although I wouldn't, or the interim period of 2001, wouldn't swear exactly on the time. But this issue in the chair's discussion with the National Marine Fisheries Services then, NOAA Fisheries now, and their concerns, one of the things they were really disturbed about and one of the impediments that we were having to getting them to accept what we were doing, accept more of what we were doing as far as salmon recovery, was the lack of utilization of the CREP program. We kind of, pursued that at the time, and I and it was with OEB, not with Department of Agriculture, and wanted to understand what was going on and why, because NOAA Fisheries, or NIMS then, saw this program as an excellent way for landowners to participate in fish recovery on those fish-bearing streams, of course, where there was basically little or no cost or maybe even some possible profit as far as that goes to them. I think both the Department of Agriculture, who we complained about, at the time, complained to at the time, and to OEB, there's been, as you can see, in Wasco County there, a significant increase in the utilization of the CREP program. And whether it was because the legislative committee had raised the level of visibility or whether it was for a combination of reasons, really doesn't matter anymore. The thing that's important is that it has become more of a utilized program. And I think for this reason is probably, with NOAA Fisheries puts us in a little better light than we were at a previous time. Now, it was not at the committee that NOAA Fisheries came and talked to us. This was in a session that the chair held with NOAA Fisheries representatives from the Portland area, that they brought this out, that one of my questions to them was, what's one of your biggest complaints, or what are your biggest complaints? And they came back to, we've got this wonderful program here and you aren't using it. And there probably were a lot of reasons that we weren't using it, and the technical expertise is maybe certainly was one. Newness may have been something of another. And the fact that a lot of these programs, excuse me, but I think were really designed for Midwest farmers and not for West Coast farmers. And the model that they have or the vision that they have when Congress prepares or Department of Agriculture and USDA, deals with these things, goes to those big ag states in the Midwest with more representatives and senators in Congress than the state of Oregon has. So my appreciation to both OEB and to Department of Agriculture for anything that they're doing to improve and increase the utilization of the CREP program. I think it's valuable for us to use it in this regard or this way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Do you think that this trend is typical of other watersheds?
I would refer that question back to the committee or to the department. They'll respond to that.
Chairman Jensen, Representative Tomei. We're seeing these types of trends. In fact, been talking with the district manager over in Harney County, who just received a small amount. We were able to provide $5,000 for some technical assistance to get them started. And in a matter of less than a month, they've already had one rancher request to sign up every stream on his property that qualifies on a 16,000-acre ranch.
Wow.
And they have another property that has adjacent to that has about another 12 miles of drainage on it. So there's an example where a little bit of outreach and a little bit of contact ended up leading to a lot of interest. And Klamath County is another good example. Right now, Klamath County's got about 44 contracts on the books to work through and write plans and to put those into the CREP program. So we're seeing this not in every county, not in every region, but in many regions. When the program gets started, it kind of just takes off.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I could, and I know that probably we didn't bring our all of you didn't bring your OEB report with you, but including the chair, but he happens to have the advantage of sitting by the staff or committee administrator, so he gets it. But in the OEB report, that we looked at, it says, quote, agricultural quality management area plans are completed for the entire state. The Oregon Department of Agriculture will shift from planning to implementation. ODA has taken a leadership role in the implementation of the CREP program, a voluntary incentive-based program to encourage agricultural conservation practices. So.
Great.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. On to what is called the CAFO program. That's an abbreviation for Confined Animal Feeding Operation Program. In the late 90s and 2000, EPA was spending some time in the state observing how the state was regulating water quality runoff, principally, at various livestock operations. This program, first of all, let me say, contributes to the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds because it has to do with preventing runoff from manure and silage and wash water that comes off of livestock operations. So it's a very important program in its contribution to the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. What led in part to the legislation that was passed in 2001 was the Environmental Protection Agency finding some violations of the Clean Water Act at some ranches in eastern Oregon and issuing some very large fines to a couple of ranchers because they were not in compliance with the Clean Water Act nor with the state water quality regulations. So then came House Bill 2156 that passed into law in 2001, and it directed Department of Agriculture.
Excuse me just a minute. I think some of you had the privilege of sitting on the Ag Committee when this bill was, and even the Water Committee when this bill was being presented and passed through the House, and so you will, a couple of you at least will recall and have some familiarity with it. Thank you. I'm sorry to have interrupted.
No, certainly. So this directed the department to change our program and our CAFO permit so that it would match the requirements of U.S. EPA's CAFO regulations. And at about that same time, EPA was revising its CAFO regulations. And that took about 2 years for them to update the federal law that is EPA's way of meeting the requirements of the Clean Water Act for livestock industry, the livestock industry. So the department put together a rules committee and revised our permit and our CAFO rules. And right now, we are about a year and a quarter down the road in actually implementing the changes in that permit program and the permit. The permit that we formerly issued to livestock operations was called a WPCF permit, Water Pollution Control Facilities Permit. That's a state permit. It's a state DEQ permit. The permit that we issue now is a federal permit, and it's called a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permit. That is abbreviated to, I know it's a terribly long name for a permit, and it's most generally just referred to as an NPDES permit. Part of this House bill directed the department to pursue getting direct delegated authority from EPA to run the CAFO program. And we are working on that, and I'm sure you hear about that from time to time because we're directed to pursue delegation, and we have been working on that. We've not achieved it yet. I'll make mention of that in a moment again. But right now, you need to know that we operate the program completely. The Oregon Department of Agriculture does. And we do this through a memorandum of agreement with Department of Environmental Quality. They now have delegated authority from EPA to run the state's NPDES permit programs, all of them. But through this MOA, ODA runs the CAFO program.
And that is with the approval of the EPA?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And thank you for that point. We also have an MOA with Environmental Protection Agency that sets out our role, how we work with DEQ through an MOA with them. It's all kind of complex, all these memoranda that connect us all and give us the authority to run the program, in addition to, you know, having the authority through statute to do so. So we changed to this federal permit. And the federal permit that we wrote with our rules committee and that we now issue is a hybrid that picks up both state water quality regulations and the federal. Federal water quality regulations don't include groundwater. It's just surface water that they handle. But Oregon's permit protects both groundwater and surface water. That's one distinction. And the other important difference between a WPCF permit and an NPDES permit is that if you are an operator and you're in compliance with this federal NPDES permit, if you are operating according to the conditions of the permit and someone sues you, you will be backed by the department and you will most likely prevail in court. If someone comes after you. The Water Pollution Control Facilities permit did not have that protective quality to it. So the department has all along believed that this NPDES permit is a far better permit to offer our producers across the state. So we offer it to facilities that are defined in federal law as a federal CAFO, and we also offer it to smaller operations that don't meet that federal definition of a federal CAFO. If you have an operation with X number of cows, for instance, you're defined either as a large federal CAFO or a medium federal CAFO, and you must, according to federal law, be covered by this NPDES permit. If you have many fewer animals, you're not required to have that. But we have put everyone inside of this one permit. Right now, we permit around 600 livestock operations across Oregon. Better than 70% of those are dairies. A lot of those, of course, are in Tillamook. We also offer and require this permit coverage of beef feedlots, poultry operations, mink fur-raising operations, and now more and more we're finding large horse stable operations are subject to this coverage.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I was just looking at your slide that talks about in response to the new EPA regs. So is that why we're seeing a jump from 500 to your estimate here of, says, 2218 operations that may need permit coverage? Is that because under the new regs it's covering more operations like the equestrian?
Yes, Chairman and Member Dingfelder. We have undertaken a fairly large outreach operation to try to find the operations in the state that are required to have this coverage. So that number reflects the number of contacts we've made to send out what we call an application to register for the permit. So once we send that out, then the person sends back information to us, and we determine whether they meet the definition that requires this permit. Or if they simply want it as sort of an insurance policy, some people do, because if they're operating in compliance with it and it would offer them protection, some people actually want the permit for that purpose. But that is not the number that we anticipate being permitted in this program. It's hard to come up with that figure, but our estimate is more on the order of 100 or 200 at the outside, in addition to what we've got right now.
And follow up?
Follow up.
So, and what happens if somebody says they refuse to register? I mean, reading through, you send out this application to register, say they are actually one of the operations that are covered by the EPA regs, and what if they don't register? Do you have to do an enforcement against them, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman and Member Dingfelder, yes, we do. In those cases, we work really hard to try to explain to them why their operation meets the definition of an operation that needs the coverage. And then we tell them that it's up to them, and if they choose not to submit the application to register, then we will have no choice but to issue them a civil penalty assessment.
Okay.
And we haven't had very many instances like that. When we send out messages to people, though, it varies how many actually respond. And there are limits to how many people we even can locate just by the lists that we have and the information that we can obtain. So we're still working on this, and it will probably take a couple more years simply to do the outreach.
I have one last question on
okay.
this point. How many inspectors do you have in the CAFA program? Because I saw you listed on the OWEB report that you do annual inspections, and that you inspected actually 98% of the permanent sites, which is pretty impressive. And so how many full-time inspectors do you have? I'm just curious.
We have 6 1/4 full-time equivalent.
Wow.
Which is, in our view, a fairly small staff. And they do a lot of inspections that are not even just those routine inspections. They do increasing numbers of what are called complaint investigations.
And are these funded through fees? Do you know how those positions are funded? I can't remember from
yesterday. Very little of the program is funded through fees. We charge only $25 to people for annual renewal. Unless it's someone who has what's called an individual permit, and that's a whole different kind of a permit that costs $6,000 or $7,000 and $700 to $800 annually. But 99% of our permit holders are registered to the general permit, and they only pay $50 for the initial application and $25 annually. So it is paid for, as you can see, in small part by the fees collected, and the rest is paid for through some general fund and the rest lottery funds or other funds.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the name itself gives me some sense of what we're talking about. Confined animal feeding operations, but let me ask a couple of questions so I can get it more specific in my head. Is this related to any confined animal feeding operation, or is it species specific to certain species?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Barnhart, it refers to all kinds of different species. If you have one or more animals, except the fish, I mean, this is, terrestrial animals, livestock. If you have one or more animals and you confine them for 4 months or more, if you're a small operation, or 45 days or more, and if you have what's called wastewater treatment works, which roughly means if there is some kind of a man-made system through which wastes, and that's typically manure and silage, wash water, is held, conveyed, processed, disposed of, then all those things together would make you meet the definition of a confined animal feeding operation that needs a permit. You can have a livestock operation that doesn't confine. We call those simply animal feeding operations, and they are subject to the statutes in the state that require that waste not be placed so that it can enter waters of the state, so that runoff can go into surface water. And you can also have confined feeding operations that don't confine for 4 months and don't meet all of the parts of the definition, so they are outside of the permit program. So there are only certain facilities that are required to have this permit. There are countless numbers of confined and non-confined animal operations in the state that are subject to Senate Bill 1010, but not required to have the permit. The permit program is a different way of regulating and enforcing the federal and state water quality regulations.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. The 4 month period that you're talking about, is that a definition of the period of time during which the confined animal feeding operation exists, or is it referring to specific animals that are being confined, or something else?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it refers to the amount of time on that operation that the animals are confined.
During a year? During a decade?
During a year. Yes, during a year.
Okay. One of the animals you did not mention, I know there's a what I would call a confined animal feeding operation in my district, is for swine. Is that one that you regulate, and would you tell us a little about that?
Certainly, Chairman and Representative. I omitted that. I wasn't giving you an all-inclusive list, and I left out swine, but I didn't mean to. We do permit hog operations. There are several dozen in the state that require permit coverage.
Thank you.
Please, Mercedes. I know we're the ones that are slowing you down, but we're not going to want to cheat Ted on it too much time here. So if you could kind of quickly go through the remainder, and then I have a couple of closing questions.
Thank you. I will wrap up my remarks about the CAFO program. I want you to know that on February 28th, there was an important decision of the United States Second Circuit Appeals Court that has to do with EPA's regulations. The judges in that circuit court heard a case that was a compilation of petitions from industry and from environmental organizations, and their decisions will ultimately alter the EPA CAFO regulations. Our AAG says that most likely EPA will request a stay. They may appeal it. It will take years. But ultimately, the EPA CAFO regulations will be changed once again. About a year ago, the Northwest Environmental Defense Center gave notice to DEQ and ODA of their intent to sue us over the new CAFO NPDES permit. And just a couple months ago, after a whole year of work on it, ODA, DEQ, and NEDC and the other petitioners reached a settlement agreement on the points that they brought. And we find now that many of the items that are in our negotiated settlement agreement are also the findings of these judges in the Second Circuit. So our permit plus the agreement that we just negotiated puts us in the state of Oregon in a very, very good position. We, at least for the next several years, we will not have to alter our permit as a result of it. The negotiated settlement agreement brings us almost all of the way there. And so this is fairly good news, I would say. And I also want to comment to you that the feedback that we've gotten from EPA about our permit and from others, including some environmental organizations, is that it is by far and away the best CAFO NPDES permit in the United States right at the moment. And people are watching with great interest how Oregon proceeds in our work with EPA to try to gain delegated authority to run the program.
What circuit did you say?
Second circuit. If you would like, I can provide you a copy. I didn't bring it with, but if it's of interest to you, I can provide a copy and our summary that the AAG and I have put together.
I'd
be
you.
Happy to do that. And then I thought I'd ask Ray to move quickly through the noxious weed and invasive species part of our Oregon plan contribution.
This program, this is Ray Jandel again, Assistant Administrator for the Division. This program is actually in other divisions of the agency, but I do want to, we do like to add it to this presentation because it is part of the ODA's contribution to the Oregon plan. We are responsible for working with counties around the state to address noxious weeds and invasive species, and there's several means by which we do that. One of those is a grant program that's money's coming through OWEB, directed to the department to distribute to counties to address weed issues. These grants have gone to weed control projects statewide conducted by county weed programs, SWCs, watershed councils, and private landowners. To date, there have been the priority projects are those that restore, enhance, and protect fish and wildlife habitat and watershed functions. There have been over 270 grants funded to date for over $3 million. There's been a lot of interest in this. There's actually over 400 requests for funding for over $7 million, and we're able only to fund up to the 277 to date. There is a continued development of something called a weed mapper. It's a web-based weed database that assists land managers in the development of viable weed management plans. This is ongoing, working with OSU to develop this. And we are also continuing to develop, pursue biological control agents for noxious weeds, such as non-native blackberries. So there are several different programs, components of this program that are addressing Oregon plant issues, primarily how they address land management and the weeds that affect soil containment on the site and maintenance of native species. The other program I didn't mention too much is the invasive species program, and that is a program that was just put into place recently, about 2001, I believe, as well. It's a council that identifies the 100 most feared species in the state, basically, and ones that we need to work on to try to get them from coming into the state. If we get them before they arrive, or when they just arrive, hopefully we can get them under control before they become a part of the system, and we then have to just manage them in perpetuum. So that Invasive Species Council is continuing to do that, continue to do outreach, try to look for educational opportunities to get that information out to individuals, again, so that we protect the native species that we have and the environment that we desire to have here in Oregon. If you will, let's continue. As you can see, there's a wealth of different programs that the Department of Agriculture has to address, to assist in the Oregon plan, and each one of them addresses a specific niche. But in general, the benefits from these programs combined contribute to reducing sediment loads, reducing nutrient and bacterial loads on waters, improving stream bank stability so we don't have the erosion, improve riparian condition and function so that again enhances the biology, the ecology of the site for fisheries, improves the temperature regimes in terms of getting riparian vegetation and shade and improving the conditions for fish and habitat as well. Our programs are not specifically designed to address endangered species or to address habitat for species, but we achieving water quality, addressing pollution, we're able to get there. And in the soil water conservation, working with them as our partners, we encourage these activities and look for ways that we can pursue them and help landowners understand what they can do to that area if they so desire. As we've indicated along, where are we going? We're shifting from a role of developing programs to implementing. The 1010 program, the CAFO program, the district program have all been developing quite a bit. We're pursuing, continue to pursue enhanced SWCD effectiveness. We're continuing to assist the CREP program. We're looking at this monitoring question that Chair Jensen requested. How do we get that information and compile it in a a good manner that we can actually follow this program and see where changes need to be made, or that we are indeed making good differences. And also, we're looking to enhance the compliance program so it is an effective program that can be used where there are egregious problems and all the issues that we might encounter with agriculture. Conclusions for us is that it's important to stay the course. It's a relatively short time frame. We are beginning to see positive results. We're pleased with that. We are seeing many voluntary efforts by farmers and ranchers, and that's one of the big challenges for us, is that we have OWEB reports quite a bit of information on things that people are doing, but it's not the complete list, because many landowners do things on their own. They don't want to work with government. They really don't care. They just want to do it. And there's no way to report that. And so there's a lot of information that is not contained in our reports that's actually going on. And on the one hand, we're pleased with that. On the other hand, we sure wish we could have an opportunity to collect that and brag more about it. But we haven't found a way to do that yet. Water quality improvements are going to be a while in coming. It's going to take time. You know, shade, trees don't grow overnight. They take 20, 30, 40 years. Where they're needed in areas, we have a lot of streams that were channelized through government programs and realizing that was not the correct way to go. Riprap was instigated in some areas, again, removing the streamside vegetation. As we begin to understand that and get programs implemented to overcome that, the CREP program or others, it's going to take a while for that vegetation to develop and for water quality improvements to become more apparent. Key thing is it's truly an Oregon approach. There's a range of programs here, all of them to address different functions of the system, and it is getting us there, and we're pleased with the efforts that we're seeing up to this point in time.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Maybe I could just ask a question or two. First one, are you familiar with the recent study regarding silt in the Umatilla Basin waters regarding the lack of farmer participation in that? Not?
Stop ringing the bell, sorry.
Okay. I'll try to get more information to you maybe on that. Secondly, in relationship to, have during the course of the biennium we're in now, have you had any reports from IMST? And if so, have you responded to them? Have you done what they ask, or so forth?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, yes, we've had quite a bit of communication with the IMST from our perspective. We have a staff member that attends their meetings on a regular basis. One of the key reports that came out this biennium was the Lowlands Report for Western Oregon, where they looked at agriculture in the lowland areas, which includes management in lowland areas, which includes agriculture, provided a series of recommendations, and we responded to those questions in several ways. One is a written response. Two, I went down and gave a presentation to their group, and we had a chance to discuss it, and followed up with that with another series of communications to them. Temperature report came out. We participated in that meeting, and as that report came out, they asked us to review it, and we did provide them comment on that, and when the report did come out again, we provided additional comment as a response to some of their recommendations. Just the other day, I got a series of requests from them in terms of understanding of our program, and because they have new members on there that don't understand 1010, CAFO, and so on. And so we were able to provide that information to them as well to help them bring up speed as they go through the COHO assessment that has recently come out, draft, come out for public review. And so we were able to provide them information there as well. Most of the dilemma that we have with them in their recommendations is they are asking us to pursue things that are outside of our purview. So they may ask us to work more on wetlands development, and our response would be something like, well, that is a Division of State Land, Department of State Lands responsibility. We may encourage it, work with it through the soil and water conservation districts and through the 1010 planning process, but we do not have a regulatory responsibility. We do not receive funding to do outreach in that area, though we may attach it to other programs. that has been some of the types of responses we've had to give to them when they raise issues about the programs that they think that we should be involved in because they could be on agricultural land, but they're actually with another state agency.
Have they responded back to you when you have responded that this is outside of our purview?
The most recent response they give us is that, you know, it's either say that our Chair Jensen, the most recent response is either favorable, not favorable, or indeterminate. And usually when we give that kind of response, they say it's indeterminate. They don't know what we're going to do.
They don't what?
They don't know what we're going to do. Or they don't, I guess they basically don't agree with the answer, but they don't know how to respond to it. That's how I interpret that.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, and we've obviously, if I keep on my schedule, we've shortened Ted's presentation by 10 minutes here.
Thank you.
Chair Jensen, member of the committee, I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I am going to try and keep this as brief as 10 minutes, which is unusual for me.
We just shortened you by 10 minutes.
Oh.
We didn't shorten you to 10 minutes.
How long do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay, we'll keep it that short. The Oregon plan by statute includes a number of department programs specifically, but it's obviously not limited to that, and certainly with regard to forestry, it's very hard not to think of what we do that doesn't relate to the Oregon plan, but specifically the Oregon plan encompasses what we call ORS Chapter 477, which is the Protection from Fire Program, which again is a unique scope of the Oregon plan that really isn't reported in the Oregon plan assessment on a periodic basis. It includes our Integrated Pest Management Program, which is ORS Chapter 527 and something that we share with ODA in terms of interest and work. It includes the Oregon Forest Practices Act. It includes ORS Chapter 530, which is the Acquisition, Management, and Development of State Forests. So those are the specific programs the Oregon Plan encompasses by statute. In addition to those programs, we have a number of other programs, like I said, that are really hard to separate from the Oregon Plan. One thing that makes forestry unique in the context of the Oregon Plan, though, back in 96, 97, when we were developing the first elements of the Oregon Plan, the Department of Forestry, along with representatives of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, sat down with the forest industry and small woodland owners, and they said, okay, what can we do with regard to fish issues on forest lands, and what voluntary measures might we develop to address these problems? And we actually came up with a set of over 60 voluntary measures that were very strong commitments that were made by a number of landowners to implement over the course of the Oregon Plan. And those measures themselves reflect a focus on road and fish passage work and to some degree on enhancing riparian protections, and those elements have continued to be a major part of our work. We do and have made reports to OWEB and did in this most recent process. The report reflects our information, and it's fair to say that collectively the forest land work still represents a major part of what's going on in the Oregon Plan. Private forest lands continue to contribute the major share, about 80% of the effort related to private sources of funding for restoration work, and that's reported work. Again, there's more than that going on. The Department of Forestry is providing about 17% of the funding from state sources of funding, and the Federal Forest Land Management Agencies also make a substantial effort, though I think I would say their reporting is probably less obvious, and I'm not quite sure I can say the report encompasses everything that they're doing, though they do make an effort at that, and it's fairly substantial. A lot of that effort has been on road work. They haven't done a tremendous amount of forest land management work, though. The Board of Forestry has a very specific interest in the Oregon Plan and has directed the department to maintain major effort in that, which we continue to do. Part of that direction has said to seek the federal recognition of the Oregon Plan that was undertaken with regard to the recent assessment work. We provided major effort there, focusing on the habitat side of the effort in collaboration with ODFNW and other state agencies. The programs I described earlier that are encompassed by the Oregon Plan really are relatively mature programs, and were relatively mature at the time the Oregon Plan was adopted. All those programs have a number of what I call adaptive management loops built into them. For example, the Forest Practices Act, we have both enforcement or compliance inspections that we do on a routine basis, looking with our field force of about 40 going out and seeing what levels of compliance are occurring, as well as working with operators ahead of the operation to plan out how it can be done effectively and efficiently. Besides that, we're one of the few agencies that have actually gone out and done a statistical sample of compliance by randomly selecting operations, putting together a technical group, and going out and evaluating the operations very thoroughly and looking at compliance levels. In either case, we found very high levels with the Forest Practices Act, but in that process, we have found areas where we can make improvements. And the advantage of the process where we've really focused on the statistical valid sample, it allows us to find kind of the core roots of the issues for noncompliance, and in part what we found was some of the problems related to lack of technical information, some of it related to the fundamental difficulty of doing some of the things. The most obvious area where we found problems was related to actually achieving installations on culverts that would allow fish passage consistent with the guidelines. And there's a lot of technical reasons for that, but again, we were able to worry those out. We've been able to provide better guidelines, and people are now doing a better job. So again, we're relatively mature in the context of our programs, and are really quite proud of those. As we have made our reports to the OWEB, the emphasis has been on the traditional forest practices and voluntary measures, but I thought I might want to spend time on here is really talking about the programs that aren't normally reported on because they're more programmatic as opposed to project-type work. The ODA staff reported on the insect and disease issues. Some of you heard our presentation during the interim with regard to sudden oak death. That's an invasive non-native species. It's something that has potentially huge impact on a range of native plant species, particularly oak, obviously, but it's not limited to oak. We are attempting eradication on that. That's a fairly strong effort that we're doing somewhat on an ad hoc basis with tremendous help from Department of Ag and the federal U.S. Department of Ag Forest Service. But really, sudden oak death is kind of a bellwether on this issue. For the first time, we've been doing surveys of forest land managers, and they've expressed that invasive diseases and insects are becoming a major, major concern. That's something that's really new. Just as some of the old-time examples, and this was a project that actually was funded, I believe, by OWEB and done by maybe ODA, but gorse was found near Sutherland, and that's the first time I was aware it was in Douglas County, and there was a joint project to eradicate that in that area. Gorse has some tremendous implications in the context of both ecosystem health and fire. In fact, if you recall the famous Bandon fire, probably the reason why Bandon burned up was the gorse fields around the town. So gorse is a big deal, but it's been around Oregon for a long time. Scotch broom and blackberry, again, are major players in repairing and management that we really haven't got solutions for. But there are a host of new vegetative insect species popping up, and those issues are impacting all our other programs as well. There are species that have the potential to be hugely significant with regard to forestry and other values, ecosystem values. The traditional focus on insect and disease management has been on protecting the commodity values, and we really haven't looked at how we're going to do this stuff with regard to ecosystem values. My opinion, and if you're looking for what are some of the barriers or issues, my opinion is the state of Oregon is a leader in these issues. We have a good partnership with the USDA and Forest Service and Ag Departments, but generally I think the federal government is relatively strapped to provide the prevention, and prevention is where we need to go. Once they're here, the costs are great, and I would hope and suggest to you that maybe it's something that is well worth exploring during the session. And again, we do a lot with what we've got, but I believe and I think with regard to the Oregon plan, it's becoming a major issue. Besides invasives, there are native plant and insect issues as well, and the fire program, the forest health issues, gets into that. Fundamentally, our fire program's purpose is to protect 15.8 million acres of forest land in Oregon, both private and public. Generally, it includes all the private lands, all the state-owned lands, and the Bureau of Land Management lands in western Oregon. The USDA Forest Service generally protects the Forest Service lands in those areas. We protect about 3.5 million acres of what's called the wildland-urban interface, where there's a whole set of different issues to deal with there that oftentimes conflict with the ecosystem or our forest land values that create some unique challenges for both salmon and the department. What we try and do is achieve the program by implementing a set of environmentally sound and economically efficient strategies that look at both total cost of suppression and damage. Now, if you look at that program, there are two basic issues that we've got to consider. The obvious one this season is we've got a potentially very, very severe fire season. And about two-thirds of Oregon's forests are what's called in a status of uncharacteristic fuel conditions, where if a wildfire does occur, the intensity of the fire can cause damage that is outside of the normal range of fire impacts. And in the context of salmon, we probably want to be in a situation where we are able to prevent those uncharacteristic fires to give us the time to deal with those natural fuel buildups in a more positive way through active management that will allow both healthy watersheds and meeting the desired forest characteristics. So we are planning a number of actions to address the fire season severity. Won't go into any detail on them, but what we have found is we basically budget for the average worst fire season, and this is not the average worst fire season. This is the well above average worst fire season, probably. There's a number of factors that relate to that. But what we found is in those above average fire seasons, by getting severity resources through the legislature, which we've generally been able to do, we enhance our initial attack resources and really aggressively attack the fires and are able to keep most of them small and less consequential. Some of the issues with regard to fire, though, relates to federal availability of retardant aircraft. And again, that's something outside of the water issues maybe, but it's really a factor in how we're able to control those fires. The state of Oregon is not historically been in the fire aviation business. Last year we had two contract air tankers. This year we're proposing to have two more. And those are big players, helicopters as well. So we're pursuing the severity resources. The second issue with regard to the fire is looking at the longer term, and we've implemented a fire program review. Part of that relates to some legislative issues that a number of you may be dealing with regard to fire insurance and funding of that, particularly for this season, and then in the longer term how we're going to do it. But Oregon's unique in that we have actually contracted or gotten fire insurance through Lloyd's of London and other carriers that will cover cost of fire above a certain level deductible, and we've been able to do that. It's been increasingly difficult for us to do that for a number of reasons. Obviously, the exposure to some of the recent high and bad fire seasons makes part of that a reality, but there's other reasons as well. But we do expect to have that insurance this year, and we should be in, if that occurs, in relatively good shape in that matter. But again, longer term, we're looking at a number of issues in terms of how the program ought to be funded, what levels of initial attack are needed, how we need to manage the fuels program. And one of the things that really isn't reported in the Oregon plan and reports very well is I think probably the thing that we've done the best under the Oregon plan, which is really start integrating amongst the agencies and amongst programs within agencies. And as an example, I brought a letter here from a constituent that was talking about one of our field staff working with them, and This is what we call a stewardship forest, and we basically combined our forest practices and our forestry assistance program into one program, so we deliver both the regulatory cost share and technical advice programs all at once. In this particular issue, the landowner was served by the stewardship forester helping secure funding for a stewardship plan, which really defines the long-term management for the private land, and then helping the landowner secure a wildland urban interface grant to do the thinning in their most distressed areas in ownership. What they found upon completion is that now they have both reduced fire risk and improved forest health and a much more aesthetically pleasing environment. The USDA Forest Service reviewed our insect and disease program. I'll be getting a report on that here in the next several months, but it really recognized we're one of the few states that are integrating the fire and insect and disease programs in a cohesive manner along that way, so where basically people can look at, okay, I've got a forest health problem, what are the tools, whether it's fire or insect and disease, cost share, we can do to produce the forest health conditions we want, and I think we've done really well there. And again, CREP is another example where we work with OLEB and OEA to provide technical assistance where we have the expertise on repairing reforestation. So I think that's a huge success in the Oregon plan. Now, with regard to state forests, again, that's a relatively mature, long-standing program. It's not a program without controversy. There are management plans that are being implemented while we continue to evaluate and explore the options. I do have some information here, what we call a harvest and habitat model project, and it's an important and key tool that really looks at how we might manage the forest under different scenarios, different alternatives, and asks then questions of what are the outputs over time and space in terms of both timber harvest outputs and other habitat values. In the context of that model, we hope to have that up and running in April in terms of some of the first testings and some more planned completions as the spring runs on. There are four alternatives we're going to be analyzing in terms of the state forest and the Tillamook and Clatsop and Northwest Oregon State Forest, which includes looking at the current plans, which assumes a habitat conservation plan to implement those plans, which is the federal ESA assurances. The current plan with take avoidance under no habitat conservation plan, a wood emphasis approach and a reserve-based approach. So we are looking at alternatives, and we should have lots of interesting information for people to look at different outcomes and outputs. We will implement this process with counties and other interests being integrally involved, and that should provide folks lots of grist to have opportunity to look at policy options. I would agree with ODA that the course is a good course and it needs to be stayed with. There are some barriers. We have had a substantial decline in field resources in particular, and one of the things we heard at the Oregon Plan Assessment Stakeholder Meeting a couple weeks ago was that that loss is being felt by the folks in the field, landowners. It certainly is an impact in terms of our ability to provide the assistance we'd like to provide. Another barrier I think that has continued to be in place, and it's really a product of different world views, but it has a series of practical impacts, and that really relates to permits to do in-stream restoration work that are now required by the Army Corps of Engineers. Basically, forest landowners have an opportunity about once a rotation to have their equipment on site and do placement of wood in streams, and if it's not a conducive process to have them do that, they're not going to use that opportunity, and the process to get a permit to place wood is not as streamlined as it needs to be, and people are more reluctant to do that kind of work now. So that's been a barrier we've seen, and certainly the amount of in-stream work that's done on the kind of landowner ad hoc basis has declined over time.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Ted, is that that's a permit that the Corps issues, or is it ODFW for that in-stream work?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfeld, and members of the committee, it's a Corps permit. And I'm trying to remember the time frame on this. until about 4 or 5 years ago, the Corps did not interpret their regulations to require a permit for that work. They had some reinterpretation of their rules. The dilemma comes not necessarily from the Corps permit, but in the fact that it's a federal action and consultations then required, and when consultation processes occur, people dive for cover and quit doing that kind of work. So,
follow up on that. And there is no way to get some type of general permit for restoration work?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, members of the committee, we've been working on that. There is a regional general permit that provides some coverage, but again, for the kind of work that forest landowners do, and this is where some of the rub comes with worldview, on the forest practices program, we've looked at providing incentives for landowners to do work, and the forest practices rules allow some use of trees that they would otherwise have to retain for placement in the stream, and the regional general permit specifically excludes that kind of work, and I guess our worldview is that you got to have incentives, and from a technical standpoint, the best any tree can have to fall in the stream is 50%. If you have 100% of it getting in the creek, you got to give people some credit for the cost of getting it there. And actually, the guidelines we developed in terms of the standards for placement are pretty well accepted scientifically. It's just that philosophical perspective that they view the world as you shouldn't take stuff out of their riparian area to do restoration work. And we disagree with that, so we've basically been a stalemate, and the amount of forest land participation has declined as a result.
That's too bad. Thank you.
I think, if I could, similarly, and I've used this anecdote several times, and those of you heard, I apologize, but we were out on a field trip looking at the restoration work on private lands, and we were looking at a large arch pipe culvert on Willamette ownership in the Clatsop County. It was a very large pipe. And it had been replaced to improve, to restore fish passage on a relatively large stream. It was a major tributary of the Nequanicum River. And we had federal regulatory agency people with us. We had federal land management agency people with us, including the head of the Regional Forest Service Engineering Section. And we're talking about this pipe, and the gentleman from the Forest Service said, how much did it cost to replace that pipe? And the alignment person said, it cost us about $16,000-$17,000 to do it. And he turned around and looked at me and said, how much would it cost the state of Oregon and state-owned forest lands to do it? It's about $16,000-$17,000 to do it. He said, it would cost us $180,000 to get through process before we'd even start on putting a pipe in. They are, again, in terms of barriers, the federal lands are woefully behind on road fish passage work, and that's a substantive issue, and again, it's nothing I think we can probably fix shortly, but it's something that, again, is in our best interest to look at in the forest land efforts. But I would also say the Forest Service and BLM both are doing well as they can, given those kind of constraints. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
I've got a few, but I'll let somebody else ask.
Well, I just have a quick one, I think. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking about pests and invasive species, and you said the best tactic to take is prevention, so how do you prevent invasive species or pests or whatever?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, and members of the committee, I'm a passionate fly fisher person. If I was to go to New Zealand, I would have to buy waders and wading boots there to go fishing. The New Zealand mud snail is now all over the western United States because fishermen have come back from New Zealand with those waders on. There's also some evidence it came from fish as well. But again, they're requiring a higher level of protection and prevention than oftentimes we might. The Asian longhorn beetle, it's something we're really watching out for. It's something that's devastating the hardwoods. They found some in the state of Washington. It was one of those interesting things where it was an urban environment. I believe it was a Department of Ag inspector or something was going into the greenhouse, opened the door, and he saw these beetles fly out, and he just knew enough to recognize them as, oh, my God, this is longhorn Asian beetle. And they were apparently brought in through containerized products from Asia, but as a result of that, they went in, and identified the trees around the Serban area, and they basically ground them up into sawdust to get rid of the, eradicate the bugs. But the public was upset. We lost our trees. We lost our park, yada, yada. So it's a big issue. And there isn't any easy answers, but we're getting lots of invasives.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think more of a comment. Down in Lincoln County, and I found some in one of my yards behind my shop. They're a knotweed, and those things you can't kill. Once you go out and chop on them, and you just spread them all over the place. You try to dig them up and load them, haul them away. You just spread them all over the country. And I had some people from Oregon State University come in, and they were injecting those plants with a hypodermic needle with Roundup and trying to get control of them. And they're all over Lincoln County, and they spread up and down the creek banks. And my understanding that they were an ornamental plant in England at one time. They were selling them, and once they get started, you can't get rid of them.
Representative Jensen, Representative Brown, members of the committee, that experience is becoming increasingly common, and you know, a number of those species, when you hand pull, there are chemicals and other elements in them that make them very difficult to deal with. And again, from the policy philosophical basis, you know, Oregon's going to have some tough choices about the tools we use in riparian areas to deal with some of those species. Again, there's some huge trade-offs there. There's no right or wrong answer. We just got to balance those things out. But on sod, as an example, we're very aggressive, along with the Department of Ag, trying to eradicate that off of forest lands. We're clearing, pulling stumps, burning, wherever we're finding, infestations. So far we appear to be having pretty good success with that. But it's kind of like a roller coaster. You look at California, and they've kind of given up, and we don't quite know all the mechanisms for spread. But you know, if everybody's not playing the same game, sooner or later you lose it. So, from our perspective, the Forestry Program for Oregon, which is the Board of Forestry's policy document, we really recognize that as a big deal. I would make as a point of information. One of the other things I think that's really change with the Oregon plan, and certainly on the forestry concept, is we're dealing with forestry issues in the context of forest sustainability. We define that as an integration of social, economic, and environmental values. Our approach has been to use a series of criterion indicators. Criteria and indicators which eventually get to insect and disease issues and invasive pests. And we are in the process of trying to figure out how do you monitor and track this. And it's fair to say we don't have a very good system at this point in time. We probably have some sense of how many new species, but we really don't have a very good sense of looking at how common something is. But the Oregon Plan really has provided the framework for having the monitoring systems to do that. And I guess that's, again, like what I'm really proud about the Oregon Plan is the interagency cooperation, interprogrammatic cooperation. We'll be meeting with the USDA Forest Service folks on what's called FIA plot data, which is forest inventory and analysis plots. There are a grid of plots all across Oregon that we look at on a periodic basis where we can monitor land use changes, timber growth, and harvest. And in theory, we can use this stuff to at least look at presence and absence of certain invasives. So there's a number of ways these kind of plot systems can be used to provide indicators, these kind of trends and changes, and the Oregon Plan has been a real catalyst to get us there. We're not totally in place yet with what those indicators ought to be, but we certainly are building those frameworks. I think that's really powerful, and again, I think the Oregon Plan has brought us there, and I think we're unique in Oregon, or in the country, with regard to that leadership.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is almost a follow-up, although I was the question I was planning to ask before, and that is this. Do you have, or other agencies have, the authority that you need in order to deal with this attempt to eradicating invasive species that are as a prevention? Or are there some things that the legislature ought to be doing to improve your capacity to actually do that, that doesn't involve additional resources. I'm talking now about authority, not resources. I think I know the resource answer.
Yeah. Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, authority at this point in time for most of the insect and pest issues lies with ODA. We have some authority for insect control districts that relate to forest pests, but not the broader authority that ODA has. We have used ODA's authority to implement the sudden death eradication program. It's worked. We feel a little bit at risk, and actually the state of Washington has adopted some legislation that does give their Washington DNR kind of equivalent to the Department of Forestry some specific authority on forest lands, and I could provide you a copy with that particular piece of legislation. I think we're working well to figure out some of these more strategic views on what we need to do, and I do believe both the Department of Forestry and myself personally believe this is a big deal. We need to put the strategic energy into it, and my bias is that there are some authority issues that we'd like to suggest, but we're probably not ready to go there at this point in time. We've not had the dialogue with the Board of Forestry and Department of Ag we need to have.
Follow. This is a different subject. So,
again, this is Ray Jandel, Assistant Administrator for the Natural Resources Division. I'll have to admit that I know just enough about the weed and invasive species program to be dangerous, since I do not work in that program very much. But I know that, again, I repeat what Ted has said, we do work quite well together to try to address these issues. Whether or not the authorities, all the authorities exist that we need, I really can't answer that question. I'd have to leave that up to the division that's responsible for that. But it has been successful in addressing things like the gypsy moth that have been coming from the east over this area with some problems, sudden oak death, working with nursery industries where they have sudden oak death in nursery. We've been able to address that this last couple of years. So I believe many of the authorities are in place, so I can't tell you for sure if everything is there that we would need.
Different topic, if I may.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 years ago, I was on the Revenue Committee, and we heard plans in connection with the Tillamook Forest concerning plans for harvesting on the Tillamook Forest. And today I heard you talking about some issues that I thought were related to those plans. And what isn't clear to me is the extent to which this increased flexibility you describe is a retreat from an augmentation of a change in the plan that we heard about 2 years ago.
Representative Jensen, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, the planning process for the Oregon State Forests, I guess, has always been intended to be an adaptive management process, and we did go through a long-term public involvement process, developed the existing plan framework the Board of Forestry adopted, and then implemented some specific implementation plans, for any better term. Despite those processes, people had different views in terms of what was the best framework for managing those forests. And in the context, I would say, is we look at management scenarios to include kind of really four general approaches, all of which have important values and as an integrated group are really important to the state. But you have the wood production emphasis forest, you have the multi-resource, which is kind of where we settle on state forest lands, and you got a reserve-based approach, and the fourth is more the urban rural type forest. And through this public process, and given how we interpreted looking at law and past history and legal issues, we interpreted things to basically settle that the multi-resource approach was the right way to go. In doing that selection, we did some modeling to look at outcomes and outputs, and for a number of reasons, the approach we used provided some information that I wouldn't call it was wrong, but every model was wrong. Some are just more useful than others. In this particular case, due to some of the revenue problems we had a decade before, we quit doing and updating our inventory of our timber stands. And so we didn't have very good inventory data, and the modeling reflected that. And so when actually it got time to implement the plan on the ground, we didn't produce the volumes that had been modeled. Again, they were always intended to be relative numbers, but people had some expectations, and from the timber production side, they were disappointed, and then from the other philosophy that preferred the reserve-based approach, again, they didn't feel necessarily that they'd gotten everything they wanted, and the modeling may not have reflected the different types of outputs and outcomes. So we agreed with the legislator last session to go through a number of processes, including this habitat harvest modeling development, to, again, look at the different alternatives with a better set of numbers to have a better set of data to make decisions or help the Board of Forestry make decisions. From a policy standpoint, I think the Board of Forestry still strongly supports the multi-resource vision, but again, there's a very legitimate debate about what the right policy is, and the board has articulated that it is an adaptive plan based upon good information. We need to adapt it, and we need to be open to hear the policy debate as well if there needs to be one. So that's where we're at, but I think the good news in the context of the Oregon plan, this modeling should allow us to look at environmental outputs in a more definitive way, along with the harvest outputs.
Thank you. And this is the nature of follow-up, but it's also a little bit of an extension. I have to say that I have appreciated the clarity with which you described the approaches you're talking about, because sometimes I've missed that clarity in my understanding of it. And also the fact that the Oregon Board of Forestry is very concerned about a scientific basis for making decisions. Recognizing that the policy issues, of course, are enormously up in the air. Witness the bill that passed the legislature last time and was vetoed, and the failure of Measure 34, was it? Both of which I opposed. I mean, both the bill and the measure I opposed, because I think I agree with where the board is trying to go in this respect, and you're being pulled in all directions, if I can say it that way. What do you think the odds are, the chances are, of our experience, if we stick the course, actually having any influence on the way the big guy makes decisions about forestry management? And the parenthetical there is, this is the grand prize. If we can get the federal government to start behaving appropriately in forest management, we can do a much better job, in my view, of managing the forest for all of the reasons that you've indicated, and make some money at the same time.
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, and members of the committee, I'll try and do this, make these comments as valueless as I can, because I think that's my role, is provide information. We look at the Forest Program for Oregon as really providing this policy framework, looking at those different roles of forests. They're all important, but in that context, the Board of Forestry has articulated that active management may be necessary in all three of those components. So that's kind of where the board's been coming from. All three approaches, dominant approaches, are adaptive management experiments. And again, a reserve-based approach has some risks with it. A multi-resource management approach has some risks with it, as does intensive management approach. The strength of Oregon is that we have a chance to monitor and evaluate all three. And we need to be smart enough to do that process in a way that can get to some of your points. Is okay, in the context of what the federal agencies are trying to accomplish, what are the best tools to do that in any one of those strategies? It's easy to describe those strategies as definitive. If you look at multi-resource strategies on the state-owned land, we have a mix of approaches. There are some not their de facto reserves in any better sense. And hypothetically, on the federal lands, they have some areas that are intended to be managed actively and intensively. They just haven't been able to do that. So there's in on intensively managed forest lands, there's some reserve areas too and riparian areas. So there's these integrations that we've got to be smart enough to look at. And actually, one of the unique things about forestry, we do have some processes, paired watershed studies, where we're going to be able to do that. From a policy standpoint, there are two big players on federal ownerships, BLM and the Forest Service. Both those agencies are soon will be undertaking planning processes to update their land management plans. The Bureau of Land Management will be doing that for their Western Oregon forests in total. And by agreement of resolving a lawsuit, they will be looking at some other scenarios that reflect those different approaches. We have certainly believed, and we have heard, I think, from the federal agencies that they think that our experiment on state-owned lands may well be helpful to them. And I've also heard the state director of BLM and the regional director of the Forest Service say that they also believe in some cases intensive forest management may be appropriate on some of their ownership as well. Again, they've got some real unique land scattered around the state of Oregon. But again, I think people, we have an opportunity through the Forestry Program for Oregon and these three basic models. And if you, we did put together an analysis, which I can provide you. It's got the data in a notebook form and a publication form, but then a CD-ROM where it looks at the ownership of Oregon's forest land and then its land use designations. And you can sort it in any way, but I mean, it looks at the reserve-based approach, looks at the multi-resource, and looks at the intensive forest management approach. And if you take it in terms of what's actually being done on the ground, about a third of the forest estate is being managed in each one of those at this point in time. And that to me is really interesting and pretty powerful. And again, if we do things well, we can look at the success of that. Some of you are well aware of the Hinkle Creek Paired Watershed Study. We are just in the starting processes of looking at sites in the North Coast that would include, hopefully, industrial land, state-owned land, and possibly BLM-owned land to either do a paired watershed study or triplicate watershed study, looking at different approaches and how they are effective and efficient meeting our objectives. So, again, I think that's pretty neat.
If I may, I'd like to make just one quick comment, and that is that I'm very pleased to know that I'm not the only one to whom the idea occurred that if we did a good job in managing our forests, we might be able to get somebody else to look at what we do and also do a better job. I appreciate your comments and also the reservations that you've expressed, and let's keep going.
Okay, great, thank you.
I could probably editorialize a little bit on that and question if we don't receive some economic benefit from that management that it is an incredible waste of resources.
And Mr. Chair, I don't disagree with that at
don't.
All.
I know you don't.
I think there's some incredible opportunities here, and if we do a better scientific job of managing the forest.
Certainly, this entire area of the natural resources that we're dealing with in this committee are vital to our fundamental survival in this part of the country.
Fairly true.
We may be able to replace it with chips for a while, but you know, maybe wood chips will still be a better product in the long run on that. So, we're at the end of the hour, and I appreciate very much, Ted.
My pleasure.
The presentation, as always, very precise in your presentation, and we thank you for that.
Okay. Sandy, the write-up on the habitat harvest model here.
I guess you're the only one, Representative Barnhart, that doesn't know what the as those who are left here. It doesn't know kind of what the schedule is, so we will have the Fish and Wildlife ODF&W here on Friday to give us a detailed presentation on the coastal coho recovery and the proposal that they are submitting to the federal agency to delist that. The IMST assessment of that is due out next week, and on either Wednesday or Friday, the date is to be determined by the IMST when they can make it. We will have their presentation of their assessment of that, and would submit for you that this is perhaps one of the first really big issues, huge issues to see come to the hopefully to the conclusion as far as our Oregon plan and the recovery of salmon, and if ultimately the federal agency concurs with our state agency, then we'll be in a position to move on. They will be in a position, i.e. we will be in a position to move on to attempt the same kind of recovery in some of the other watersheds or some of the other basins that we have. Probably the Lower Columbia or Mid-Columbia, probably Lower Columbia will be their next objective. But it's a, you know, there are those of us who look at this as anxiously as some people looked at the court decision on PERS that just came out. Because, and in fact, it may be in some ways a bigger economic decision, huge that the PERS issue might have been. The long run for Oregon, this may be a bigger economic decision than the other. So this comes up because of the timing of when that report has to go to the feds, and we're getting it basically hot off the press, sort of thing. So.
Great.
Thank you, gentlemen, again, and appreciate your taking time being here. Always a pleasure. Yes? We're adjourned.